Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everyone. We're having a great conversation with the Reverend Al Sharpton, founder and CEO of National Action Network and all around good guy, colleague of mine at MSNBC, and the author of the new book, Righteous Troublemakers, Untold Stories of the Social Justice Movement in America. It talks about the men and women out there who do the everyday lift of fighting for justice, reminding us of what justice means in this country. And the Reverend has put this book in sharp relief by telling the stories of men and women that many of whom you may not be familiar with. And so I highly recommend you pick up a copy and get a little history lesson, but also get a better appreciation, understanding of what your neighbor has done over the past few years of moving the agenda. You talk, Reverend, in the book at one point, and you made reference earlier to the older gentleman that had come down and, you know, who wanted to show you his button and say, I was here before. You then go on and you talk about, and I thought this was a very interesting juxtaposition of the moment. It didn't go unnoticed by me and others that only a few hours earlier, and just 1 mile away, President Donald Trump has stood on the South Lawn of the White House to condemn us. In his mind, we were agitators bent on destroying the American way of life. I don't give too much about Donald Trump talking about the condemnation of anybody, because Donald Trump condemning someone is not worth the time to discuss. But what I thought was important about what you said, and you put it in quotations, was the American way of life. What is that for Black folks versus what it is for white folks?
Black folks come into American life at birth with a socioeconomic disadvantage. When you're born and your race is on your birth certificate, they can almost say what kind of zip code you're gonna live in, mm-hmm. quality of education in that zip code, the employment opportunities, which is qualitatively different than whites, that some whites don't even understand that. So you are doubly unemployed, even in a good economy. But the unemployment rate is a little under 4% now. It's over 7% for blacks in a good economy. When you deal with the quality of education, when you deal with the quality of healthcare. So this is systemic, and it makes them feel that we are other than, but they do not understand it is not based on our acumen or our intellect. It's based on a system that first saw us as chattel and then as commodities, and all the way to we fighting for the full realization of being full citizens and regarded as full human beings. That's what the struggle has always been about. And I think that a lot of us do not understand that these things are what we are facing and have faced throughout American history. So when you get a guy like Mitch McConnell that slips and says, well, African Americans vote like other Americans, it's their subconsciously don't see us as Americans, because Americans are supposed to be upwardly mobile and landowners and profitable and all that. And they don't see us in that stereotype, though many of us are.
Right.
But it is because much of us have been systematically excluded from that we become something other than, rather than people realize that is the designation we're given. That's what the struggle has always been about.
It's true on so many levels, because you find yourselves, I mean, I just, when we were talking, just thinking back to some of the experiences that I've had, you know, presumably on the other side of the civil rights movement. You know, the marching had been done, the voting and civil rights have been passed, and everybody was singing Kumbaya, yet I'm sitting in Georgetown Law School, and I've got this white boy who looks at me and said, well, how did you get here?
Wow.
I'm like, oh, okay, we're gonna do that. All right, let's do that. Okay, we're gonna do that. And, you know, we got into it because he goes on and says, well, yeah, I had a buddy of mine who applied to Georgetown and didn't get in. I went, well, I guess he just wasn't as smart as I am.
Wow.
And the reality of it was, we are always having to prove ourselves from the moment of birth to death. And what is what is so compelling about that scene that you had with the older gentleman on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial 58 years later is you think about his life, you think about your life, and you think about the lives of the young people in front of you. And the sad part of the narrative is there are a lot of aspects of it that haven't changed. You're still having to prove yourself. You know, Reverend Al is still having to stand up in front of white corporate America and say, y'all just need to sit your butts down now because y'all got this wrong. Let me tell you what you need to do.
Right.
You know, young people today are still having to confront, as much as we are much more symbiotic in our relationships and across cultural and embracing all these various communities, you still see, you know, young white boys in khakis and tiki torches. Protesting the civil rights of their fellow Americans. You note I think it's around page 135 or so in the book, where you say, one of the reasons I'm still an activist, why I still link arms and march, is because I don't want anyone to accept being treated like a slave, someone less than. I protest that very ideology. You have to be out front and raising your voice for someone else to understand that they too don't have to accept that kind of thinking. So when you look at the older gentleman, yourself, and the young people that day, you begin to appreciate that sentence. You know, why you still do what you have to do, because you're constantly trying to change the thinking. Trying to get people to see you first as a human being as opposed to a black man, and that's all right. The stereotypes that come with that. So you're gonna stay in the fight till that work is done.
That's my life commitment. I remember when Michael Brown was killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri, and we went in, the family asked us to come in, National Action Network. And I remember we were at a rally one night at his church, and his mother said something that really got to me. She said, Mark Twain said something. And I'm like, Leslie's going to quote Mark Twain? And she said, Mark Twain said, the two most important moments in your life is the moment you're born and the moment you find out why you were born. And she said, I found out that I was born to fight for mothers like what happened with my son. Yeah. And I sat there and said, that's why I can't stop. I feel that that's what I'm born to do, to say to people that we must affirm our humanity. So people thought when I was younger and was out there marching and carrying on, he's trying to make a name. Well, I have a TV show now, a radio show now. I got an organization all over the country. I have access to the White House. Why am I doing it now? Because those are just platforms to give the public on why I do what I do. I still do the same thing, whether it's Trayvon Martin, whether it's George Floyd, whether it was 30 years ago in Howard Beach. And the other thing that is important, Michael, that people don't understand is that even if you don't win every case, I was glad we won the Aubrey case with George. I was glad we got convictions with George Floyd. Even if you don't win every case, young black kids like me that grow up in single parent home on welfare, they realize they're of value when they see people stand up for them. Because I can't tell you the amount of young people said, you know, at least somebody cares. Imagine if there was no protest and something happened to a George Floyd. The message, the subliminal message you send to everybody is we don't matter.
We don't matter. It's okay.
And we don't even matter to ourselves. Yeah. So that's why I go, because I can't tell you in the last 15 years when I've become more known and respected, is that the reaction I get in most places when I go to a Brunswick, Georgia, or even Minneapolis, I didn't think you would come, because they have been subconsciously feeling that, well, we ain't all that. Yes, we are. All of us are. And we've got to affirm that.
And the response by some, and including some on my side of the aisle in the Republican Party, is that when you show up, they don't focus on the why you're there. The young individual who's been shot and killed by the police or some other horrific moment, they focus on the personality of the man.
Exactly.
So they try to make you the caricature, the bad guy in the scenario, and sublimate the truth of what why you're there. How have you dealt with that part of this? Where you
I've tried
take yourself out of the narrative.
I've tried to break it down to put the families out and the narrative out, but then at the same time, tell the families that let me take the flak. See, because no family, and I write in there about George Floyd families and other families, Philonis and all, and I stay close to these families down through the years. The one thing my staff, we have offices all over the country, and they always laugh, is that Reverend Al will not let us get between him and the families. I call the mothers on Mother's Day and Christmas. I'm talking about cases I fought 25 years ago, because you end up kind of drawing that kind of relationship.
Sure.
And what I try to do is deflate the attacks on them, because they don't volunteer to be activists.
Right.
So if they didn't beat up on me, they go dig up.
And they're dealing
guy.
With the pain of a loss of a loved one or something, you know.
The trauma of it.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to protect that. But at the same time, I said to a guy, I won't call his name, the host of the show at Fox News, who does these caricatures of me. I said, let me ask you something. I said, there's nothing more sacred, particularly in the Black church, than funeral. He said, yeah. He says, I think that's true in our church. I said, well, have you ever noticed that I never broke into a funeral? The family asked me to come and deliver the eulogy. That's a very serious thing. He said, I never thought about that. I said, what you need to do is ask yourself, why do they ask for me? Because then you'd have to deal with the cause they want raised rather than the character that raised it.
That's right. That's right.
It wasn't like I was their pastor, but mm-hmm. they wanted that statement made. It just happened to be Al Sharpton. It could be anybody.
Right.
As long as that statement is made. These people weren't members of National Action Network or the NAACP, but these people wanted that statement made. And rather than deal with the cause, you want to deal with those that make you have to hear the call.
Well, and that makes it easier to deflect, because they don't want to have to deal, like you said, with that underlying reality. And more importantly, their response to it.
Exactly.
There's nothing worse than a mirror being held up to you.
That's right. And give you an example. You mentioned earlier about Donald Trump's attacks on Al March and on me, and he's attacked you and everybody else. And people have said, New York Times did a story on the front page about how we were frenemies, because I used to deal with him and fight with him in New York, but he'd always invite me to his functions and the boxing matches and all.
Right.
And I said to a guy, I said, let me ask you something. I was coming to Baltimore. I remember this attack. And you were going to be there. We were doing something
That's
with
right.
some of the business.
That's right.
And that morning, he had tweeted something against me. I was a con man. I was this, that, and other. Well, who was I when you were sitting at ringside at boxing match? So, I mean, in one minute, you say Al and I were friends. Well, why were we friends? I'm the same Al Sharpton. I've been that for 30, 40 years.
Right.
So it is clear that if you try and give us these caricatures for political reasons, you don't even believe that yourself.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
All right, America. You asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.